It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Michael Christman is the new special agent in charge of the FBI's Pittsburgh office, succeeding Bob Jones, who retired in March. In his 28 years with the Bureau, he's worked in Cleveland on a gang drug task force and at headquarters in the Capitol, managing the Bureau's cyber criminal investigations and overseeing national threat operations. This is not his first stop in Pittsburgh. He previously worked in the Pittsburgh field office for 10 years, supervising violent crime and later cyber crime investigations. Mike, welcome back to Pittsburgh.
Kevin, thank you so much. I'm very excited to be back in Pittsburgh, which I consider to be home.
When the FBI appointed you to head its Pittsburgh office, did the Bureau leadership give you any specific direction, any mandates, any goals that you're hoping to achieve right away?
Well, I would tell you, Kevin, I had a long conversation with the deputy director of the FBI, and he asked that I focused on our relationships with our federal, state, and local law enforcement partners and our ability to detect, deter, and respond to critical incidents. During our conversation, again, the deputy knowing that I had been in Pittsburgh from 07 through 2016, we discussed Pittsburgh's reputation, which is that of a very proactive, innovative, and high-performing FBI field office.
Are there any specific other goals that they would like you to achieve, you know, immediately?
Certainly. We have always been at the forefront in cyber matters, and it's really due to a global approach that's been fortified by great private sector and international law enforcement partners. We've also been very fortunate to partner with a forward-leaning United States Attorney's Office, and they themselves have embraced a leadership role in the international law enforcement community. So again, we want to continue to be at the forefront in cyber matters. We also keep a pulse on national priorities and emerging threats, such as counterterrorism, counterintelligence, and public corruption.
Is cyber more challenging, in a sense, tracking down where it's originating?
You know, cyber is it's extremely challenging. And what I would tell you is, again, we've had success with cyber matters based on our global approach and partnerships. And I see similarities in our cyber approach with the approaches we've had in violent gang and drug investigations. By that, I mean we have been really proactive in identifying conspirators across multiple jurisdictions and countries, identifying their conspiratorial roles in something that we can call an enterprise or group, and then by blending both traditional and sophisticated techniques. And so I see that similarity really across all the work that we've done here. And it's, believe it or not, it was a new approach in terms of cyber investigations, and it's been very successful for us.
Throughout your career, you've investigated gangs, violent, organized crime, cyber crime, national threats. What do you think the average Pittsburgher should be most concerned about, maybe feel most threatened by?
Well, certainly we prioritize relationships with our community partners and our local law enforcement partners, and we use those relationships to garner input in order to refine our strategy and identify opportunities for enhanced collaboration. And based on that input to date, we see a tremendous need to focus our resources on violent crime matters, gang matters, and drug trafficking matters.
Do you have any leeway to decide on your own the focus of the Pittsburgh office, or is it all from the top down, Washington directing Pittsburgh?
I think it's a combination of the two. So I think that we certainly have national priorities that we are going to address, in some respects, have sole jurisdiction in those areas. But again, we are going to develop mechanisms to receive input from the community and our local law enforcement partners. And we're going to be sensitive to the needs of the local community and divert resources, I think, as we have always done, in those things that affect our local community the most.
The Senate Intelligence Committee unanimously endorsed the findings of the U.S. intelligence community that Russian President Putin directed a wide-ranging hacking effort to influence the 2016 election. Chairman Richard Burr, a Republican, called Russia's interference the new normal. Do you agree? Is it the new normal?
I would certainly say that, our adversaries are very active and seek to cause unrest in the United States, and I think seek to create doubt with respect to our elections and our democratic processes.
So what can the Pittsburgh office and your colleagues across the country and at the headquarters do to thwart interference from bad actors this election cycle?
Well, it's certainly collaboration on a global scale, remaining vigilant, sharing information, developing joint collaborative investigations as well, and I think certainly being forward-leaning and proactive where we can in blending traditional investigative techniques and sophisticated techniques.
Is there room for innovation right now, given the pandemic?
I mean, I believe there's always room for innovation. Innovation doesn't just mean technology. And I would go one step further in saying if you are not constantly evolving and growing, in a sense, you're dying. So we will continue to try to be at the forefront in terms of developing innovative tools and practices.
What fallout do you think this current moment, this pandemic, might have on the Western Pennsylvania region in terms of criminal investigations?
You know, I think the effects will be minimal. From what I've seen in my first week in the office here, our folks have found creative ways to continue to develop their investigations and to continue to partner with their law enforcement community. I think with respect to the FBI enterprise, we have some people who are working flexible schedules, working from home. And I think the enterprise will certainly look at some of those things as opportunities to develop a future workforce that can maybe continue to do some things remotely or possibly from home. And I think some of that would maybe mirror what we see in today's private sector.
Anything you anticipate chasing when society is able to resume?
No, again, I don't think so. Again, I think operations and investigations have not subsided here. As an enterprise, again, I think the FBI will look for creative ways to facilitate flexible work. We've talked about telework. So I think the Bureau enterprise will continue to look at that. Some of that doesn't impact a field office the same way that it would impact FBI headquarters, because, again, what we do in a field office is much more dynamic in terms of investigations and operations.
What do you mean? On foot? Out of the office? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, again, the backbone of what we do is partnerships. It is, in some senses, being on the street, conducting investigation, talking to people, be it witnesses or potential subjects. And so, again, I think with respect to a field office or even local law enforcement, a very hands-on approach is still required to get the job done.
Mike Christman is the new special agent in charge of the FBI's Pittsburgh office. Thanks for taking the time.
Kevin, no, I appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In these last few months of work from home and self-isolation, many of us have caught ourselves looking up at the night sky a little more often. That's something we likely share with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's headed to Pittsburgh in October for a talk on the cosmic perspective. The engagement was one of many events rescheduled due to the pandemic. The Confluence's Megan Harris spoke to him in March from his office at the Hayden Planetarium in New York City.
So I don't know how familiar you are with Pittsburgh, but we have a pretty rich history of benefactors who once invested very heavily in things like telescopes and glass and all these techniques to advance what in the late 19th century was kind of the cutting edge of astronomy. Pittsburgh, of course, isn't alone in that. I wondered if you see any parallels between kind of how we accomplished that early research and now, when it seems like the super wealthy are, again, the ones pushing the boundaries of space exploration.
Yeah, that's a perceptive question. I think the wealth to today is a little bit more democratized than a century ago. Back then, you had, you know, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers, the, you know, you had this family wealth. And today, because you can gain wealth, even if you don't have access to big industry, all right, wealth can now be generated because of your intellect. So the kinds of people participating on that frontier tend to a little more diverse than I think what was going on 100 years ago. But that's just a social cultural observation. In terms of the behavior, the access to space cost way more than anything the wealthy folks were doing 100 years ago or at the end of the 19th century. It's one thing to fund a telescope or an institution. The Carnegie Institute is a significant presence on the moving frontier of science.
Now known as Carnegie Mellon University.
Yes. In fact, Carnegie's name is all over the place for noble, progressive causes that advance our understanding of our world. So the cost of that is much less than the cost of access to space. So the people today who are wealthy and want to go into space, there's just a little bit of crazy in them, right? Just enough to believe that this is what should happen. And I think the people who have always historically moved society were those who others might have viewed as just a little bit crazy, just a little bit. So in other words, whether or not their dreams are even realistic, the path to the dream, because it's always about the path, can lead to all manner of other unexpected discoveries or technologies that enable or empower civilization in ways you might not have seen or predicted. So I think, yes, there is a parallel, but the cost is, I think, much higher. So they're actually risking their financial stability by engaging in these activities, whereas that was not the case 100 and some years ago.
You know, one of the great things I think about space and astronomy is that no one really owns our night sky, right? It's for everyone. But lately, there's been all this discussion about how, you know, folks like Elon Musk have launched so many satellites for broadband internet connection and other things into orbit that we're kind of polluting our night sky now with all this light. I wondered how you think we as a society should be handling that. How do we prevent, you know, losing this wonderful resource that we've always had?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think things start out not knowing that you're polluting things, right? When the car was invented, no one, even upon viewing black smoke plume out of the tailpipe, no one is thinking one day this is going to be a major world problem with air pollution. No one is really thinking that. Perhaps because at the time you had these huge smokestacks at every factory on a river's edge. And, oh, that's just the air. The air will clean it up. I'm not worried about it. And so awareness and perspectives that can move your mission statement to a new place in the service of protecting a future, that usually is delayed from the first steps that offend what it is you want to correct. So, you know, we've had satellites in orbit ever since the 1960s. And even before Elon Musk launched his constellations for broadband internet, there were thousands of satellites in orbit, thousands, and not all of them alive, right? So it's not a new problem. I don't mind it coming to the front as a conversation, but you can't uniquely implicate Elon Musk, given that we've been doing this for 50 years.
Right.
And it's only just been accumulating.
Do you look at these devices as a form of pollution, or are they just kind of something we should be, I guess, mindful of as we put more of them up into orbit?
Yeah, I'm still thinking about it. The greater issue to me is not the satellites that enable technology on Earth's surface. It's the space debris that puts other satellites at risk, as well as human life to and from the space station. The night sky on Earth has been light polluted for a long time. That's why the best telescopes are in Hawaii, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, or in the depths of southern Africa, where the nearest city is at a great distance. We're already planning, we don't have the money for this yet, but we're planning that if we become a very spacefaring civilization, we're going to put our best telescopes on the far side of the moon. So the Earth isn't even in the picture. The Earth never even shows up in the sky. and was shielded from the radio waves and light and all kinds of other pollution. And there's no air, so there's no air pollution. So that's our long-term goal.
What kind of investment will that take?
Well, so we don't lead this kind of thing.
Of course.
Modern astrophysics has piggybacked other geopolitical forces that have created these opportunities. So just as a reminder, I don't know how old you are, but the astronauts, this was known at the time. Today, we look back, we don't think about it. But I'm old enough to remember the selection of the Mercury 7 astronauts and all the rest of the astronauts of the Apollo program. All but one of them is drawn from the military, and 100% of them served. So we're going to the moon, we think, oh, because we're explorers, and it's in our DNA, and we're going to do science. Well, wait a minute, no, Russia is threatening. And so there's a geopolitical reason. Now we train the astronauts to do science on the moon, and that's what happened. So if we have bases on the moon, on the near or far side of the moon, it won't be because they're in the service of science. Not likely. Not my read of history telling me this. It's that we would have geopolitical reasons for being there, and then we piggyback science missions. Oh, by the way, while you're clearing the spot in the far side of the moon, how about, can we put a little observatory on the side? Let's say, sure, that's an easy payload to bring with us.
So you're coming to Pittsburgh for a conversation about the cosmic perspective. It's all about context, right? Dismantling the fragile human ego.
Yes, yes. And it's unfortunate that our ego is fragile, because when you dismantle it, the people feel low. But if you went in there with either no ego or just a flexible ego, you can learn about where we fit in the universe, and it can become quite enlightening. And it can embolden you to play a stronger role in what we are doing to shepherd our civilization into the future, so that our descendants will be proud of what we have done with the earth that they have inherited, rather than embarrassed by us for what we have done that have made it unlivable for them. So a cosmic perspective also, by the way, doesn't only have to come from space. It can come from their biological perspectives, their chemical perspectives, perspectives brought to you from the frontier of science that just make you rethink your place in the world. And that's what this talk is and will be. And I think it's my intellectually and emotionally richest talk that I give, because it touches so many aspects of what science has done for us as individuals, as a species, as civilization, and what it can continue to do for us as we go forward.
So when you consider your place in the universe, you know, for you, is that smallness enlightening or is it terrifying?
It's both. It's initially terrifying, but then you pause and take a breath and you look up, and that's when you realize that your atoms are traceable to the beginning moments of the universe itself, as well as two stars that have exploded billions of years ago, having manufactured those elements in their cores, then exploded, scattering that enrichment into gas clouds that then form a next generation of star systems, including ours, that gives you access to carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and silicon and iron and all these ingredients that are fundamental to life as we know it. So when I look up, that's what I think about. I think I'm not simply in this universe. In fact, it's figuratively and literally true that the universe lives within us. And for me, that's one of the greatest thoughts possible in this world, your connectivity to the universe. So for me, the message would be, we want to feel special for being different, but maybe we're special because we're the same.
That was astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson speaking with The Confluence's Megan Harris. His talk on the cosmic perspective is scheduled for Thursday, October 8th at the Carnegie Music Hall of Oakland. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Special thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Julia Zinkovich, and Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.